ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors at the ETF Store and sponsored by Legg Mason. Legg Mason's sponsorship is not an endorsement nor a recommendation for any product or service. Legg Mason Investor Services LLC is not affiliated with the ETF Store, ETF.com, or any of its affiliates. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All investing involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is no guarantee of future results. The ETF Store owns and is responsible for all program content. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Legg Mason is a leading global investment company committed to helping clients reach their financial goals through long-term actively managed strategies. Legg Mason offers a broad range of equity, fixed income, alternative, and cash strategies worldwide. It is comprised of a diverse family of specialized investment managers, each with their own independent approach to research and analysis, and has over a century of experience in identifying opportunities and delivering astute investment solutions to clients. To learn more, please visit leggmason.com.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate, Connor, and Jason will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
All right, we have an absolutely loaded show this week. As always, I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. On the podcast will be Jillian Del Signor, head of ETF distribution at J.P. Morgan Asset Management, who's a top 10 ETF issuer with nearly $30 billion in assets. They've actually had some of the most successful ETF launches over the past couple of years. We're going to focus on bonds and bond ETFs with Jillian. In particular, why you might want to consider active management in this area. And you think about the stories we've seen in the bond market this year, the yield curve inversion. There's been a lot of talk about negative interest rates, right? There's something like $17 trillion in negative yielding debt globally. And then last week, we actually saw rates pop. So there's now talk that perhaps rates have bottomed. And you add all this together, bonds might be the single most challenging area of investing right now. So we're going to get into all of this with Jillian, including looking into a few J.P. Morgan ETFs. So she'll join us here in a bit. Also later, ETF.com's Laura Krieger is going to cover what's always one of her favorite topics, ESG ETFs. She wrote a piece last week about how an iShares ESG ETF took in nearly $500 million last Tuesday. She also explained how iShares overall is really dominating ESG ETFs right now. So we're going to talk about that. And then I also want to ask her about this new U.S. vegan climate ETF, which the financial media had a field day with this thing. It was beat up pretty bad. We'll see if Laura thinks that was justified. Now, we're going to start this week with CFRA's Todd Rosenbluth, who is one of the best in the business covering ETFs. I have a number of topics for us to get into, including the Michael Burry passive bubble controversy, which we haven't had a chance to cover yet on the podcast. We'll also talk ETF flows. I'm going to ask Todd what his favorite new ETF is so far this year, all sorts of stuff. And because Todd has become a regular guest on the podcast, I've decided he deserves his own intro. So without further ado, we're going to jump right in this week. Let's chat with CFRA's Todd Rosenbluth. All right, Todd, so what do you think? You have your own walk-up music now. Do you recognize that?
I do. Wow, we're bringing back the Inside ETF so-called fake meat wrap that I offered since you were going to talk about perhaps the vegan ETF. Wow, that's my new intro. That's an honor, and it's an honor to be kicking off the show instead of having the folks at ETF.com shine their expertise on everybody.
Absolutely. And for our listeners, if you're not familiar with Todd, he's Senior Director of ETF and Mutual Fund Research at CFRA. CFRA is one of the world's leading independent investment research firm. Todd's based in New York City. And as it turns out, Todd, you and I had a chance to visit in person at the WealthStat conference in Arizona last week. And I don't want to spend too much time on this. We did recap the conference on last week's show. But I am curious, any quick thoughts or takeaways from that conference?
Well, it was great to catch up with you. And for those that follow Nate or I on Twitter, I turned the tables and actually asked Nate some questions while we were at the event in a quick low-tech version of a video. So thanks for doing that, Nate. I really enjoyed the conference. It was refreshing to be around so many advisors. That's the core audience for CFRA with our stock and our ETF research. It was great to be able to meet many more of those in person. I found the collegiality of everybody there to be really strong. I was a little surprised. I would have thought there would have been a bit more competition, the way it tends to be often in the asset management industry. I really enjoyed the panel I was a part of. I was on with, you're going to talk with Laura, but I was on with Dave Nadig and Eric Balchunas and Tom Lydon, Ben Johnson and Elizabeth Kashner and Matt Hogan. Well, I just got everybody's name out there. And we tried to cover the gamut of ETFs in a similar way that we've done beforehand. And I guess lastly, the thing that I enjoyed most was just seeing some of the folks that I know of within the financial services industry, but I only know about on Twitter. You and I met earlier this year for the first time.
That's right.
There's a lot of folks that I haven't met whose content I follow and I respect. So it was great to be able to do that. Ben Carlson of Ritholtz's team being one of them. Some of the advisors that are out there. I won't name everybody. That just wouldn't be possible. There were 700 attendees. But awesome conference and great to be there with you too.
No, you as well, Todd, and I think that's what stuck out to me is that we're all out on Twitter or other social media, and that's really, I feel like, taken the world and made it feel a lot smaller, but being able to meet people in person and feel like you already know them, I thought was just tremendous. But if I had to boil down the conference into a few words, I mean, it was definitely a forward-thinking crowd. There was a lot of collaboration. It was a very collaborative crowd, and then certainly tech savvy. So, and yeah, I enjoyed the panel you guys did on ETFs. Okay, so I have a whole grab bag of ETF topics for us this week. I thought we'd maybe start with ETF flows because I know you track these pretty closely. Of course, the markets bounced back after hitting a speed bump in August. We're right back close to record highs. There's also been a lot of talk recently about the value factor coming back into favor and investors actually fleeing momentum. So anything showing up in ETF flows over the past month or so, whether on factors or just the market as a whole?
Well, I think what's been really encouraging, so we've had a year that's been largely dominated by fixed income and more defensive investing. So the lower volatility or the dividend approaches have really resonated with investors, despite the fact that we're up nearly 20%. For the year in the S&P 500, but equity ETF investors and the trading crowd largely went on vacation in the summer, as I think is normal, but we saw strong inflows into SPY, SPY, that's the Spider S&P 500 ETF, into IWM, that's the Russell 2000 product from iShares, the Triple Qs saw some strong inflows to start this month, and we haven't really seen a lot of money moving out of the defensive areas, so it's less of a rotation and more, I think, money that has been sitting on the sidelines. Gold, I guess, saw a little bit of a paring back in the past week or so. GLD was the largest outflows, but the largest inflows in SPY to the largest outflows in GLD is nearly 10 to 1. So it's clearly a sign that there is still money being put into the ETF space, and we might see, you know, if this continues, obviously equity will punch above punch their normal weight, as opposed to, you know, fixed income dominating the way that we've seen for much of the year.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about that. I don't know if you caught the podcast a couple of weeks ago, but we had Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas on, and I asked him what he expects from ETFs the remainder of the year. He was pretty bullish. He thinks between a dovish Fed and Trump's desire not to have the stock market go down heading into an election year, he thought investor demand for stock ETFs could be pretty robust. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that's like saying in the beginning of the year the Yankees are going to make the playoffs. They do year after year. And so it's more of an anomaly and a fluke when that doesn't happen. I'm a New Yorker, but I'm a Met fan who's this year, when we actually have a shot and paying attention in September, you're noticing more and more. So I would put the Mets in more of the fixed income camp. I do think we're going to see equities continue to recover. I think the fourth quarter typically is a strong one for equity risk-taking, and that's perfect for the triple Qs and the SPY and IWMs of the world. And if that's the case, then yeah. Eric will be right. The Yankees will make the playoffs again.
And I think we're off to a pretty good start here, because ETF.com reported last week that some $20 billion had gone into U.S. equity ETFs over that week time frame, which is, you know, that's a big number. You start posting that week after week, and it adds up pretty quickly. So, okay, let's assume we do get a big rush of money into stock ETFs, passive stock ETFs. I have to ask you about this Michael Burry story. And I'm guessing by now most people have heard this. So Michael Burry, if you've seen the movie The Big Short, you know who he is. He's the guy that correctly called the subprime mortgage crisis. But now he's saying there's a bubble in passive investing, right? Index investing. And he did this interview with Bloomberg. Let me read some of this. So he says, quote, "Passive investing has removed price discovery from the equity markets. This is very much like the bubble in synthetic asset-backed CDOs before the great financial crisis, and that price setting in that market was not done by fundamental security level analysis." And then Todd, just to further tee you up here, Bloomberg reported last week that assets in passively managed U.S. stock funds surpassed those in actively managed funds for the first time, which sounds like pretty scary stuff. So give us your response here. Is there a bubble in passive investing?
Emphatically, no. So let me try to break down these in a couple of different parts. I'm going to start with the second part of it. More money in passive equity funds than active equity funds. Yay, that's great. Congratulations. That leaves a lot of money outside of this equation. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but together that's certainly less than half of the overall market. Most investors have equity exposure through individual stocks. Or the most money is done there, and the most trading that we see in companies like Apple and Microsoft are at the individual stock level or in separately managed accounts. So it's easy to see passive more than active and think that's a bad thing, that there isn't anybody calling the shots on this, but that's not the case. There are individual stock picking that's happening. I think what's also notable, although not that you should have said it, is that Michael Burry is investing in the areas that he's talking about, saying that are missing, that are being off the cuff, you know, off the radar for investors in small cap value. The tail is not wagging the dog in this case. The stock market sets the pricing, and then that impacts whether or not an ETF is going up or going down, not the other way around. We've seen example after example of stocks within the S&P 500 that significantly underperform the broader market, despite the fact that money is going into the S&P 500 index-based products. We've got a whole host of, you know, we've got dispersion that is wider than I think it's been, the biggest gainers and the biggest losers within a period of time. There is no bubble that's there. What there is a potential investment opportunity for folks that want to steer from where the overall money is going into large cap growth stocks. Sure, buy small cap value, and you can do it in the ETF wrapper from Vanguard or iShares for a couple, you know, dozen basis points or less.
Well, and I think one thing to do is sort of invert this thesis, and the question would be asked, if index funds didn't exist, where would investors put their money? And guess what? If you look at active managers, they pretty much hold all the same stocks as passive managers, right? And part of that is you just have a lot of active funds that are really closet index funds. If there's a bubble anywhere, I would say there's a bubble in closet index funds. It's in the process of being popped. But in aggregate, active managers hold the same stocks. And active managers are the ones who are actually setting prices too. If you look at where the underlying trading happens, you know, in index funds, it's responsible for something like 5% of trading, right? The other 95% are active price setters. So, you know, I think that needs to be mentioned. And then to your point on dispersion, Ben Carlson, A Wealth of Common Sense, just had a great blog where he looked at the differences in returns and the constituents of the S&P 500. There's a wide dispersion in terms of returns. Chipotle's up like 87%. I think there was a biotech stock down like 47%. Even looking into the fourth quarter last year, we had a 20% down move in stocks. And I didn't hear anybody blaming that on indexing, right? So it just seems like this is like a scare tactic that's thrown out there.
Well, and I agree with everything that you said. And the scare tactic is presented to the public by so-called credible voices in this space who work in the active management world. And so I can understand why they're fearful, but they're fearful from a career risk perspective and not fearful for the greater good for investors. And so, sure, they should invest in a way that best suits them and their client needs. But to just piggyback onto your point earlier, the reason why SPY owns Microsoft as the largest holding and Apple is the second largest holding and so forth is because the broader market has set the price and said those are the most valuable companies in the United States. It isn't the index firm showed up in the middle of the party and just decided to drink what everybody else was drinking. That doesn't mean that it's going that they were the cause for it, and they didn't bring the beer and chips.
Yeah, people want exposure to stocks. At the end of the day, that's what this boils down to, whether index or active, people want exposure to stocks. And something else I'll mention too, I think some people misconstrue this with me. Look, there's nothing wrong with active management, right? If you want to try to pursue alpha in the market, you understand that you may get some tracking error, that you may be paying higher fees, that's fine if you want to do that. And I think active managers should be trying to sell their value versus disparage indexing, right?
And well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, and I was just going to say, the other thing too is if there is a bubble, an indexing bubble, if indexing is truly distorting prices, then shouldn't active managers be knocking the cover off the ball, taking advantage of this, right? Isn't that exactly what they want, prices detached from reality?
Yes, and value-oriented strategies would shine if that was the case.
Right.
The stocks were doing so. But I would disagree a bit on one thing that we didn't cover, but I'll just expand on, is we at CFRA believe that you can create alpha by using ETFs and be tactical if you choose to do so. So our research is focused on the valuation of the ETFs, of the securities inside the ETF. And so the ETFs that we like the most are based on what we think the stocks inside are attractive. And so if we favor small cap over large cap because we think that there's greater investment opportunities in that space, or the inverse, or we may choose growth over value, or we may choose certain sectors. So there is fundamental research that's being done by many investors. Some folks are just buying the cheapest product around and the most broadly diversified product. But the exposure you get in SPY and IWM, because we touched on those earlier, are completely different. There's absolutely no overlap in the securities between those. So the fact that both are seeing inflows, it's not an additive effect. It's not compounding. These are two different slices of the market, large cap and small cap, not all money going into the same product.
No, that's a great point. And really, it gets back to everything in investing at the end of the day is active, right? If you're making a decision to whether allocate to the S&P 500 or small caps or everything in between, those are active decisions. Let's move on from this. We could probably do an entire show, but I want to get to another seemingly controversial topic, which is ESG investing. So last week we saw the launch of the U.S. Vegan Climate ETF, ticker VEGN, which this thing was absolutely crushed by the financial media, at least from what I saw. Any thoughts on this ETF? And I should note, we are going to cover this in more detail later with ETF.com's Laura Krieger, but I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so this is a theme-based ETF, but it's exclusionary in nature. So most of the theme-based ETFs that we have in the industry and that you certainly talk about on this podcast and in other mediums focused on robotics or cybersecurity or cannabis, those are narrowly focused in what they include. This is exclusionary, so it attempts to exclude companies that are not appropriate from a climate perspective or an animal rights perspective, and it has an excellent name. It has climate and animal in its name, if I'm getting the name correct. I'm sorry, vegan and
vegan.
Climate in the name. Sorry about that. And piggybacking off of that. But it holds large cap growth stocks because they're not avoiding, they are not touching the climate issues that are a concern, or vegan. We're big fans of ESG. We think that the growth that we've seen this year, which is assets more than doubling, still on a very small base, we think there's tremendous potential with some of these broadly diversified products that are 15 basis points and less offered by iShares and Vanguard and DWS are particularly compelling. 60 basis points for a product that sounds like it's offering you exposure to something that it's actually not focused on, because there just isn't a lot of vegan-oriented companies, there's certainly better options to go at. And I think they're making a great attempt at this, but it's a shame that this is going to probably go down in the ranks of, like, the Nashville ETF, where, you know, that has a name that catches the financial media's attention, but stays, you know, investors steer clear from, and it ultimately meets its maker later on, a year or two later.
Okay, let's close with a few quick rapid-fire questions, and some of these are similar to what I asked Eric Balchunas a couple of weeks ago, but I thought it'd be good to get your perspective as well. So first, on this topic of the vegan ETF, do you prefer hamburgers or veggie burgers?
So I'm a meat eater, but my wife is a vegetarian, so she's a fan of the Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat, and we eat vegetarian.
Which, by the way, the vegan ETF doesn't own.
It doesn't own that. Again, that's what it's not offering the exposure that you might think it has. But you can fool people into doing it. I get fooled into eating a vegetarian chili all the time because when we ground the beef up, or the fake beef up, it becomes something enjoyable tasting, and I don't miss the fact that there's no ground beef or ground turkey in it.
All right, so you're split in the middle here between hamburgers and veggie burgers.
With full transparency, yes.
Okay. On the topic of new ETF launches, your favorite ETF launch so far this year, and to be clear, this is not an investment recommendation.
Correct. So I'm going to, I guess, try to cheat a little bit, and I'll pick the one that I like, but call it more the suite. I think when Direxion launched earlier this year, the relative weight suite of products, so RWCD is the cyclical over defensive ETF. We talked about that with our clients recently. They really changed the game. You know, instead of choosing just cyclicals, or instead of just choosing developed markets, or instead of choosing growth, you now can make the case that you want to have something relative to one another. So this is 150% cyclicals. It's short to defensives. So you have heavy weightings in technology and consumer discretionary. You're shorting consumer staples and utilities. And if you want to make that call, this is the strategy in one ETF wrapper is a good way of doing it. So I'll call out those Direxion products favorably.
Yeah, and shameless plug, we had Direxion's Dave Mazza on the program earlier this year, and he walked through that entire lineup. I agree, it's a really interesting lineup. I haven't checked assets to see if investors have taken to them yet, but certainly a very compelling suite. Okay, is there an ETF expected to launch over the next several months that has your attention? Just something that you think has a real shot at success?
Well, we're really excited about, I think we're alone in this camp, but or this minority of folks that are excited about these non-transparent ETFs that should come to market in the coming months. I know you've talked about the Precidian model beforehand, but I think there is a investor base that likes active management, that likes the manager, that wants to keep that, but wants an ETF wrapper for the tax efficiency. And so there will be cannibalization risk that's there, but I think a number of firms that are out there, and I won't call out one in particular. I think we're going to see products from American Century and Gabelli and perhaps Goldman Sachs by the end of the year. Those are some heavy hitters that offer in the active management space.
Okay, last question, and perhaps it's the same answer to the one you just gave. What's the one ETF story you're most interested in tracking the remainder of the year or even into early 2020?
Well, I'm going to go back to the conversation we had about flows, and I'm really hoping that the Mets make the playoffs, that fixed income can pull it out over the equity universe, and we can see, you know, I think it would be a really strong sign if we continue to see inflows into equity products, but the fixed income products, the core products, the high yield products really punch above their weight. I didn't touch on it, but it's about 20% of the overall ETF universe, so if we can see them overtake equities, I think it'll be a great sign for the industry's growth, because you'll get broad asset allocation both with equity and fixed income. So I'm rooting for fixed income to stay ahead. It's about 60-40 right now with equity, with fixed income to equity. So they get, can give a little bit of ground, but I'm rooting for fixed income to make the playoffs.
Well, Todd, always fun having you on the podcast. Keep up all of the great work you do over at CFRA. Really appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll chat again soon. Thank you.
Thanks, Nate. Great podcast.
That was Todd Rosenbluth, Senior Director of ETF and Mutual Fund Research at CFRA. You can find him on Twitter, at ToddCFRA. All right, our next guest is Jillian Del Signor, head of ETF distribution at J.P. Morgan Asset Management. J.P. Morgan is a top 10 ETF provider. Jillian is also co-president of Women in ETFs, which is a tremendous organization focusing on equality and diversity across the ETF industry and really just the broader investment space. Jillian is on the line with us from Chicago. Jillian, always a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, I'm happy to be here, Nate. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so we're going to focus on fixed income this week. And I mentioned at the top of the podcast, I think bonds might be the single most challenging area of investing right now. And nothing's ever easy in investing, right? But it does seem like investors are having a really difficult time wrapping their heads around fixed income. And you look just this year, we've had an inverted yield curve. There's something like $17 trillion in negative yielding bonds around the world. Last week, we actually saw the 10-year Treasury yield spike the most since 2016. So what do you make of the bond market right now? Just at a high level, do you agree this is a difficult environment for investors?
Oh, absolutely. I will tell you, as I'm on the road with my team talking to clients, it's certainly a huge part of what we talk about and the bulk of what we talk about. Because as I think about the bond markets right now, I think of one, maybe two words, and that would be uncertainty, very much to your point, and volatility. I mean, just a few months ago, we were all positioning and expecting rate hikes. And here we sit, you know, following a cut. And even within our own firm, if you talk to our global fixed income team, you know, they expect cuts at the next three meetings. If you talk with our chief global strategist, Dr. David Kelly, and our market insights team, which I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with, they expect at least one, possibly two more cuts this year, but think that the Fed really will be challenged to stop there. So even internally, you know, we have differing views, just illustrating that uncertainty that abounds in fixed income markets right now. And you know, thinking about that, the yield curve inversion, it was interesting. Dr. Kelly recently said that that's not even something that you should necessarily think of anymore as that infallible indicator of the pending recession, because if you think about it, we're coming out of this decade of unprecedented monetary policy, zero, even negative rates, as you mentioned, around the world. So this really doesn't even resemble the bond markets we've had in the past, which just adds to the uncertainty, I think, that investors, especially the ones that we've been talking to, certainly feel, as you mentioned, and really are struggling with what to do from a portfolio perspective.
Well, your point just on J.P. Morgan's internal resources trying to make heads or tails of what's going on, you know, that's really enlightening, because very few firms, if any, are bringing the intellectual capital to the table that J.P. Morgan is. And so just to see how difficult it is assessing the environment, I think that speaks volumes. And, you know, something else, too, I think here is just looking at risk and reward, right? And I've mentioned this on the podcast previously, but let's say you look at something like the 30-year U.S. Treasury. You know, does that strike you as a great investment opportunity to loan your money to the government for 30 years at 2.4%? The risk reward just doesn't feel good there, even though maybe it does end up being a good place longer term. I think that's a good example.
Absolutely. I mean, I think as I look at our fixed income lineup, particularly within ETFs, you know, that's one of the things we've really worked hard to do as we've constructed that lineup within fixed income, is to provide just a whole host of choices. You know, I mentioned our global fixed income team earlier that, you know, they run a global bond portfolio that has the flexibility to invest everywhere across the world, not tied to any duration or sector or anything along those lines, have ventured into factor-based fixed income. I think folks are getting less and less tied to benchmarks as they become more aware of some of the challenges related to those benchmarks and are allowing themselves some more flexibility when it relates to investing in what is becoming really challenging fixed income market.
Yeah, and I want to get into some of those JP Morgan bond ETFs, but I thought before we do that, a good point of comparison is maybe to look at ETFs tracking the Barclays U.S. Aggregate Bond Index, because right now, the two most popular bond ETFs both track that, right? And I think a lot of investors look to this for the core of their bond portfolios. However, I know based on past conversations you and I have had, you do see some shortcomings here. So do you want to start there, and then maybe we can get into the JP Morgan ETFs?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's a really important topic because, you know, generally speaking, you know, I think about my many, many years in the ETF industry, and I think most investors, not all, most investors understand that market cap weighted equity indexes are really constructed and the companies are weighted based upon the market capitalization of that company. So the larger you are, the larger weighting that you get, the more expensive that you are, the higher weighting that you get. And that can lead to large overweights in particular sectors and stocks. Now, if you move to the bond markets, I would argue that it's really not well known how passive indexes, ones that you mentioned, are really weighting. And that would be akin to market cap weighting, debtor weighting. So what that means is that in something like the ag, the most indebted companies are getting the highest weight in the index. So I just don't think that people fully appreciate the dynamic there. And that index, which has historically been, you know, sort of that ballast in the portfolio, it has meaningfully changed over the years. And if you look at one of the most significant changes and one that we've been spending a lot of time talking about that's really surprised clients as we've talked to them is to hear about the expansion of the corporate sector in particular in the index. So there's been this rapid growth in corporate debt issuance, which has pushed that expansion. So if you look at that index today, approximately a quarter of that index is in the corporate sector, and that's up from 17% in 2008 and actually is a 35-year high. And if you even take a little bit of a deeper dive, that driver of the increase has been issuance of the lowest quality bonds, triple Bs. So it's that sector that's driving more of the risk in that index. And I just don't think that people appreciate that change in something like the aggregate over the past, call it, couple of decades.
Well, something else here, too, similar to my point on the 30-year U.S. Treasury, in the ag, we've seen the yield continue to come down, as we have in bonds across the globe, but that duration has stayed pretty consistent, if not ticked up a little bit. So I think that's made it, you know, even more challenging. Okay, so let's run through a handful of bond ETFs that J.P. Morgan offers, and I think the most direct alternative to the ag is the J.P. Morgan U.S. Aggregate Bond ETF, ticker JAGG, JAG. This is actively managed. Do you want to explain the overall investment process here?
Absolutely. So JAG, as we refer to it, is actually, while it's registered as active, it's actually systematic. So think about it as the extension. I think a lot of folks have historically thought about factor-based investing as beginning and ending in equities, as we as an industry have talked so much about factor investing over the last number of years. This is our extension into, one of our extensions, into factor-based fixed income, which is a really a new frontier and one we're really proud to be leading the way in. So JAG is really taking a look specifically at the corporate sector of the benchmark index, what I just talked about, the one that has really been growing in size over the course of the last number of years. And what we're doing is we're applying that systematic process to pick the most attractive corporate issuers, looking through the lens of value, quality, and momentum. So taking that factor-based approach to the corporate sector of the ag. So said differently, looking for undervalued companies with strong profitability, low leverage, and recent positive performance in credit markets. And so again, we're only doing this on the corporate sector, but then because we do want to be benchmark aware, if you're asking someone to replace that core balance in the portfolio, we're sensitive to benchmark awareness. So then duration and sector matching it back to the index. So it's a more thoughtful approach to the corporate sector without taking on that large tracking relative to the index. And for 7 basis points, you know, our clients that we're talking to are finding it a really compelling solution to deliver on more enhanced returns, particularly during those stressed credit environments, than you would get with more of the traditionally passive managed exposures.
And to be clear, is there any manager discretion here, or is it entirely systematic?
It is entirely systematic.
Okay. Now, a couple of other ETFs that caught my attention are the JP Morgan Global Opportunities Bond ETF, which you were alluding to earlier, ticker JPGB, and then the JP Morgan Core Plus Bond ETF, JCPB. These are also both actively managed. Do you want to run through either or both of those?
Sure. I can touch on JPGB. It's a bit of a mouthful sometimes, give you a little bit of color on that. So JPGB is run by our global, actually both those products you mentioned are run by our global fixed income currency and commodity business. It's about $500 billion business here at JP Morgan. And it was really exciting for us, as we have with all of our products, to be able to bring that really successful capability into the ETF market. It was something that we really didn't see, right? There was a bit of a gap in this space in the ETF market. And so what JPGB is, you can think about it as really kind of that best ideas, highest conviction ideas coming out of that global fixed income team. You know, they're able to navigate these really uncertain markets that we've talked about with that flexibility to invest across the globe. So if we were to just sort of boil it down, they're investing across 15 sectors, 50 countries, and they can shift dynamically duration, sector allocations to really try to produce returns in all markets and minimize volatility despite market conditions. So that for us has been something really compelling as clients, again, as I mentioned, are kind of looking to pull themselves a little bit away potentially from that benchmark orientation within fixed income to really seek opportunities where they can, given the uncertainty in markets.
And so would this best be thought of as an unconstrained bond fund or a go-anywhere fund?
That would be precisely right.
Okay. And Jillian, going back to the ag, and you begin to touch on this a little bit, and really, I guess this is a question for bond indexing as a whole. Is there something inherent to fixed income that makes active management potentially a better option than what we see on the equity side?
You know, it's so interesting that you mentioned that, because if you look at the marketplace, if you look at the ETF universe, the bulk of the assets sit in passively managed strategies, some that you mentioned earlier. And I really think that it's because of a lack of choice. Because if you look at the broader asset management industry, the bulk of the assets actually sit in actively managed products. So I think that investors are telling us with their dollars, as well as anecdotally when we're speaking with clients, they tell us they really do value active management in fixed income. I think a lot because of the uncertainty that exists, and they want the portfolio managers to have that flexibility. And also because I think there is this challenge, if you look particularly at the sort of the core benchmark index and how much it's changed. I know if we look at our fixed income lineup, almost everything that we've put out is either going to be in the systematic vein or in the purely active vein, whether it's JPGB, JCPB, or even our largest fixed income ETF, JPST, which is bringing our global liquidity business, active management, into the ETF industry as well.
Yeah, and I think you just look at the numbers on the active side for fixed income. The performance numbers have been a lot better than what you see on the equity side. And something else I'll mention, I think there's a tremendous opportunity in the factor space for bond ETFs. So we were talking about JAG earlier. To me, this is really where we could see a proliferation of strategies.
I think, and what's interesting, Nate, is that so if you look at, I think, one of the things that we spend a lot of time talking about, clients ask why, you know, has it taken so long to see something like a factor-based ETF come to market? And it really has to do with data. And if you think about, I'll use GE as an example. You know, if you're looking at GE stock, it's GE stock. If you're looking in the bond world, there's many, 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 many different GE bonds. And so it really took some time to be able to sort of collate all of that data and really be able to effectively navigate this from a portfolio management perspective and put something like JAG into market. But given the receptivity that we've seen, the funds up to $200 million in assets in less than a year, which we're pretty proud of, with a lot of momentum, I think you'll expect to see a lot more of this come to market.
Jillian, you mentioned JPST, so that's the JP Morgan Ultra Short Income ETF.
Yeah.
This was one of the biggest ETF stories last year, right? It took in a bunch of money, I think primarily because investors were concerned about rising rates. What about this year? Has that reversed at all with rates coming back in, or are you still seeing flows into the ETF?
We are seeing flows into the ETF. You know, it's interesting to your point. I mean, JPST was an amazing story last year. We launched this fund in May of 2017, $100 million. started last year at $100 million and sits today at $8.5 billion. So a lot of that flow did come in last year. But this year, we've seen $3.5 billion still come into the fund. So really, if you look at it, it's been, to your point, last year, it was all about pulling in duration, right? And that was clearly the story. This year, we've continued to see a couple of different things, really three main use cases. One is money has continued to move down the curve into the short end because they're able to capture attractive yields given, you know, sort of the yield curve inversion that we talked about earlier. And what's interesting about JPST, it's remained really attractive because you can actually obtain a very similar amount of income and yield to the aggregate index for a fraction of the duration, interest rate risk, and credit risk. So a lot of folks have been pairing JPST with ag-like products like our own JAG, which has been an interesting trade as well. We've continued to also see money move out of cash, so out of money market funds and deposits as those rates have started to fall. And they're looking to take that one step out from cash because, again, JPST is not a cash product. But if they're willing to take that step out from cash and pick up some yield that they've seen fall on their money market products. So it's been really interesting to see the different use cases that have continued, despite the fact that we are no longer sort of staring down the barrel of a potential rising rate environment. And as we mentioned, have raised, you know, close to $4 billion just this year.
As you know, there are some other ultra short income ETFs on the market. What do you view as the differentiator here? Why do you think there has been so much investor interest?
Yeah, what I think is so great about JPST, and this is kind of what I mentioned earlier about our GFIC, our Global Fixed Income Currency and Commodity team. You know, if you look across the JP Morgan ETF lineup, what we've been able to do is bring across the board our proven investment capabilities into the ETF industry. And that is incredibly well illustrated through JPST. It's managed by our global fixed, our global liquidity team. This is a team that manages almost $600 billion in liquidity, ultra short, and short duration assets. So a lot of the competitor products out there are managed by bond managers that are coming down the curve. We have a global liquidity manager that's moving just slightly out the curve, and they take a really conservative approach. And so I think that's been a really valuable component of the story for JPST, is having that management capability, that active management capability, and bringing it into the ETF wrapper with something priced at 18 basis points has been also a very attractive price point for us. But I think more than anything, it really has been bringing that capability of our global liquidity business into the ETF realm. And then you start to see, you know, you sort of start with advisor usage, and then it starts to gain scale and liquidity, and then you get institutional usage, and then it starts to snowball from there. And that's precisely what we saw with JPST over the course of the last year and a half.
Jillian, we have about 2 minutes left on a completely different note, and this probably won't come as a surprise to you, but I have to ask you about the JP Morgan Beta Builders lineup.
Sure.
And specifically the Beta Builders U.S. Equity ETF, ticker BBUS. So, look, there's been a lot of talk recently about larger firms like JP Morgan allocating to their own ETFs. Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas calls this bring your own assets, BYOA, and a lot of firms do this. But I was just curious, BBUS is currently the lowest cost ETF on the market without using any fee waivers. It's only 2 basis points.
Right.
But it hasn't really seen the assets that some of the other beta builder ETFs have. A few of those hit $1 billion pretty quickly. The question I have is, can you tell us anything about the process for how ETFs are allocated internally to ETFs like BBUS? And are you surprised at all that this ETF hasn't grown as fast as the others?
No, I mean, we are incredibly excited about BBUS and adding it to our Beta Builders lineup. The Beta Builders lineup has been a really valuable addition to our overall suite, and I'll touch on that again in a second. But related to affiliates, you know, they are their own institutional investors and have their own due diligence processes that they manage. But if I look at the broader Beta Builders suite, I think what's been so valuable is the ability to bring at an incredibly competitive cost across the board these building block exposures for institutional and retail investors who are looking to get much more nuanced in the way that they're allocating and are looking for those building blocks. And so what makes me excited about the whole Beta Builders lineup, one of the things I should say that makes me really excited about the Beta Builders lineup, is if you look across our entire suite of products, which certainly has grown meaningfully since the 4 years that I've been here, actually 4 years this month, we've always aimed and have delivered on building a product lineup that crosses asset classes, equities, fixed income, which we've talked a lot about today, and alternatives. And now, with the introduction of the Beta Builder Suite, we're able to do that not only across asset class, but disciplines. So Beta Builders being purely market cap weighted, active, like JPST, JPGB, like we talked about earlier, and factor-based. So not only something like JAG, but our factor-based equity, both multi-factor and single factor. So I think it's really helped us fully build out our suite and make our conversations with clients that much more consultative and being able to offer such a huge breadth of product. So I think the Beta Builders have added to our lineup in a pretty meaningful way.
Yeah, we should mention BBUS is not unique in terms of its low cost. If you look at the other Beta Builders ETFs that are out there, all extremely low cost, highly competitive in their respective categories. Jillian, thank you so much for joining us this week. Excellent discussion as always. Look forward to visiting again soon.
Awesome, Nate. Thank you so much.
That was Jillian Del Signor, head of ETF distribution at JP Morgan Asset Management. All right, let's chat with ETF.com's Laura Krieger.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
I ran the numbers again for the cheapest ESG ETF portfolio. These are good numbers. They're not marijuana good, but they're pretty good. If you believe that it's going to save you in the apocalypse, you might want to consider something else.
Laura, so you wrote a piece last week on how this iShares ESG ETF, ticker ESGU, it broke through $1 billion in assets. And remarkably, on Tuesday alone, it took in $500 million. You also explain how iShares really seems to be dominating ESG ETFs as a whole. First, any idea on the source of flows into ESGU? I was wondering if maybe this was a similar situation to what we saw earlier in the year with Ilmarinen, right, the Finnish pension company. They allocated to two new ESG ETFs. Any idea on the flows?
You know, that's a good question. There really isn't any particular insight that I have on that yet. I don't think we will know until the 13F filings come out later on. It's always sort of it's not something that we can figure out because flows are anonymous for sure. But ESGU did take in a fair amount of money. It is very similar to some other ETFs at the top that have also taken in a lot of money this year. So it's definitely a developing story.
So what about iShares overall? I think right now they have four of the top five ESG ETFs. I guess it's not that surprising to see iShares all over the leaderboard for any ETF category, but anything noteworthy about ESG?
Right. Well, I mean, that was what I was going to say is, you know, BlackRock is everywhere at once, right? But when it comes to ESG, I think it's just kind of an obvious slam dunk for them philosophically. They've positioned themselves as the clear leader in this space. They've pulled in $3.4 billion year to date into their ESG suite. That's more than went into all ESG ETFs last year. So that's pretty good for them. I think as a company, you know, the trend toward greater investor consciousness, more awareness, it sort of aligns with this vision that Larry Fink has been presenting for a couple of years now. You know, BlackRock wants to be the firm that you think of when you think of ESG and impact investing. And to a large extent, they have been, right? You know, SUSE, S-U-S-A, and DSI, those are both iShares products. They're the oldest ESG ETFs. And for years and years and years, they were the largest ESG ETFs. But now you have Vanguard coming into the space. You have Deutsche Bank coming into the space and others when others coming in. So they just want to hold that ground. You know, they're not willing to cede it.
One question I have, if you look at the top five ESG ETFs, so the four iShares ETFs, and then USSG, that's the Xtrackers MSCI USA ESG Leaders Equity ETF. And you highlighted this in your piece as well, but there's really not much differentiation between these.
There really isn't.
Yeah, so,
you know, I follow this for a living. Like, this is my beat, and I cannot find meaningful differences between four of these funds.
Right. And so I guess that brings up the question, if you're iShares, why launch products without much differentiation?
That's a really good question. And I think some of it comes down to a question of new versus old, right? So, you know, SUSE and DSI, which I just mentioned, they are the oldest ESG ETFs. You can refine these indexes a little better now, right? You know, there are more relevant and exclusionary, more relevant and targeted exclusionary screens. There's more refined ranking methodology, more innovative indexing structures, that sort of thing. So, you know, some of these products, SUSL and USSG, these are newer products. They came out earlier this year. ESGU, the one we were just talking about, came out in 2016. So some of this is a new replacing old story. But at the same time, I think some of it is, you know, SUSL and USSG, like you mentioned earlier, they were products that came into existence after Ilmarin came to iShares and said, we want to start this ESG fund, right? So they're, to an extent, custom-made products. I don't think BlackRock was going to turn down the $1 billion, right, that came into these, into this fund. So I think that's why, to an extent, why SUSL exists is because they were approached and, you know, they weren't going to turn down the money.
And all of these ETFs at the top, they basically start with an exclusionary screen, correct? So they'll exclude alcohol, tobacco, gun manufacturer, so on and so forth. And then they're effectively ranking the remaining stocks on different factors like the environment or diversity, labor. Is that right? The gist of it? But there's really not much tracking difference here from the underlying index.
Right. That's exactly it. And so they'll differ, you know, when it comes to the exclusionary screens, they'll differ on maybe how they classify weapons manufacturers. You know, does it civilian firearms retailer count? Does a civilian firearms ammunition dealer count as weapons manufacturer? And so they'll differ on these minor refining points, but generally speaking, these funds are structured exactly the same. They start with exclusionary screens and they go into a ranking methodology. That's kind of how it goes with that. Now, what's interesting about these funds, I think, that may get kind of lost in the shuffle is that they do aim to achieve market-like performance. They aren't trying to prize ESG purity over anything else. They definitely are aiming to be replacement funds for some or maybe all of your equity exposure.
And they're all relatively cost effective as well, too. So not as cheap as they're not 4 or 5 basis points, but somewhere, you know, 10, 15, 20 basis points.
Yeah, you look at the top 10, all of the top 10 largest ESG ETFs, all but one of them are 25 basis points or fewer. Just pretty good. You know, that's pretty good for a price tag. The only exception is TAN, which is the solar ETF, and that's got its whole other can of beans with, you know, securities lending and all that fun stuff. So,
Laura, you mentioned Vanguard earlier. So they have two ESG ETFs that launched last year, tickers ESGV and VSGX. We've discussed these quite a bit on the podcast, but they recently made some headlines, not for the reasons they would like. There apparently was some sort of an issue with the index data they received from FTSE. And so these ETFs actually own things like gun stocks. So I guess two questions here. Any thoughts on that? And then two, are these getting traction with investors?
Well, I actually had a chance to sit down with the Vanguard chief of ETFs over at WealthStack, and he assured me that they have processes in place now to prevent this from ever happening again, and so on and so forth. So, you know, we'll see whether something like this happens again. I do think it's interesting that, you know, you take a look at the flows into these two ETFs from Vanguard, and together, by the way, they're over $1 billion in assets. So that's not bad for funds that just launched a few months ago. You look at the fund flows into the, to the net inflows into these funds, and they didn't lose any money during this whole indexing snafu, which to me, rather than, I mean, as much as you can read flows like tea leaves, right? To me, that suggests that Vanguard is the one using these funds, and they're not going to pull money from their own funds, even though there's, you know, this big backlash. I'm interested in how these funds have steadily grown their assets. You take a look at the fund flows over, you know, every day or so. ESGV, that's the U.S. one, the U.S. stock one, it's bringing in $5 to $10 million. The international one, VSGX, is bringing in, you know, $10 million, $20 million every week. Slow, steady growth. I think that is the approach that Vanguard is taking with these funds. It's interesting to me that they didn't lose any money.
Well, the cynic in me might say that that's because the end investor, once they invest in a, you know, quote unquote ESG fund, they're not really concerned about the underlying holdings, right? And, you know, we can talk about gun stocks explicitly being included, which obviously that's a no-no. But I still go back to, if an end investor has ESG beliefs and you look at holdings in these funds, you still are going to have holdings that maybe don't have the greatest record on the environment or diversity or whatever the case may be, right? Because there's no one size fits all. So I just wonder if investors are who are in these ESG funds say, okay, look, we're going to try to do a little bit better, but we understand that there are going to be some companies that maybe do some things that we don't like. And so as it relates to the gun stocks, they're almost willing to give a free pass here because they know, or at least they feel like the longer term goal is a good one. I don't know. I could be wrong.
So a counterpoint to that, real quick, is that, you know, ESG issuers get asked all the time, you know, and I do it too, right? As a reporter, I do it too. I ask, you know, do the stocks within your index match the purity? You know, do they meet the purity test? Are these stocks going to be ESG enough, right? Or do they meet these guidelines? And the truth is, it's kind of an unfair question, right? Because not every ESG stock or stock that shows up in an ESG index is going to meet 100% of the criteria 100% of the time, just like not every stock in a value ETF is going to be value 100% of the time. You know, it's something that gets thrown at ESG funds way more than any other type of fund out there. I think because they are marketing themselves as kind of an ethical alternative, and everybody likes to pick on somebody who's taking a stand, right? But it's you know, of course they aren't going to be meeting all of the ESG standards all of the time because no stock can do that. And that's why we have index selection criteria and rebalances and so on and so forth. There's mechanisms built in to make sure that these indexes, these ETFs, stay true to their objective, right?
Okay, so this is perfect. So you mentioned purity test. Let's talk about this U.S. Vegan Climate ETF, ticker VEGN. This launched last week. And from my perspective, this thing was absolutely bludgeoned in the media. So as an example, let me read this to you from the Wall Street Journal. They said, quote, first there was Beyond Meat, now there is Beyond Investing. The investment advisor launched a vegan ETF this week that looks remarkably like an index fund, costs a good bit more, and will even bleed realistically in a bear market. And I would say that was probably the nicest part of the article. So, good example here. What are your thoughts on that ETF?
Well, so I think maybe the the Wall Street Journal's being a little unfair because for, you know, like we were talking about earlier, you know, this fund isn't trying to be anything but, you know, an index fund. It is an index ETF. So why is that a bad thing suddenly? And it is trying to provide market-like performance. So why is that a bad thing suddenly? You know, I had a lot of conversations at WealthStack, and I apologize for continuing to bring this up, but, you know, it was WealthStack. It was a cool conference. I had a lot of conversations with kind of the next gen of advisor, you know, that young, scrappy, hungry advisor who may not have a lot of assets under management yet, but they're going to get there, right? They're the new generation. And every single last one of them brought up ESG as a way, and we talked about this on the podcast last time, it was a way to connect with their clients. It's something their clients are asking about. They don't want to be invested in gun stocks or private prisons or whatnot. Now, veganism, maybe it's not something that's on their radar, but there really haven't been any options up to this point. So maybe it could be. I think the real challenge that the vegan ETF is going to have is one of differentiation. So a large part of what the fund hangs its hat on is not investing in fossil fuel companies. That's a significant portion of their exclusionary screen. But we already have U.S. large cap ETFs that are ex-fossil fuel, you know. The State Street Fossil Fuel Reserves Free ETF, that's ticker SPYX, that's one of them. And that fund has almost $400 million in assets, by the way. It's no slouch in terms of assets. But a lot of the holdings between the vegan ETF and SPYX are the same. I think the top 10, six of the top 10 holdings are the same, and in roughly the same amounts. The other challenge is that vegan costs 60 basis points. And I just don't think you can get away with that in the ESG space anymore. Like we were talking before, the top 10 largest ESG funds, 9 of them are 25 basis points or less. And they also provide market-like exposure. So, you know, vegan's going to have to, I think hard about whether it wants to stay at that 60 basis point threshold if it can compete. But that said, and I said this on Twitter, so I apologize if it's a bit of a repetition, but I was actually kind of impressed digging into the fund's prospectus. Vegan considers not just animal friendliness in terms of like the exclusionary screen, but it also looks at human rights records of companies and labor rights records of companies. So to that extent, vegan is actually more thoughtful about what it means to be vegan than some vegans I know. it goes above and beyond for that. So for that, I applaud them.
Okay, so you mentioned Twitter. I don't know if you saw any of this last week, but and this isn't a new argument. I've seen this for the past couple of years. But the thought is, instead of expressing your social views through your investments, just invest in a low cost. Let's just say invest in a low cost index fund, take the money that you save and donate it to whatever your cause is. Right. So if it's, you know, in the realm of vegan, take the money that you save there and donate it to, I don't know, animal shelters or for better care of animals. Any thoughts on that line of thinking?
It's certainly a way of going about things, but if you truly believe that you want to, you know, you want your money to benefit a certain way of benefiting the world, right? You don't want your money to contribute to animal suffering or human suffering, then it doesn't make sense. Honestly, if you're being consistent, if you're being internally consistent, it doesn't make sense for you to invest in companies that are harming animals and then turn around and, you know, it's not a carbon offset program. Like it doesn't work that way. You have to, if you really believe in this, then you're going to stick to your guns. You're going to be consistent and you're going to want to have options that allow you to invest according to your philosophy. So yeah, I mean, I can see that as an approach, but for true believers, I'm thinking maybe this is probably a good option for them.
Okay, so our focus has been on ESG ETFs. You've mentioned the WealthStat conference several times. If you caught our podcast last week, for listeners, we recap this. And one of the, I'd say the bulk of our conversation was focused around direct indexing, right? So one of the big highlights was Patrick O'Shaughnessy unveiling something called Canvas. This is a portfolio customization tool. And again, for simplicity, I'll just call this direct indexing. But Dave Nodig, so your colleague, he made the comment that he could see direct indexing swamping demand for ESG ETFs. And so the question I have for you is everything we covered today sort of off or not? In other words, 5 or 10 years from now, will investors even use ESG ETFs, or will they all just use direct indexing?
That's a really good question. And I don't disagree that ESG investing is a perfect application of the direct indexing technology. It just makes sense, right? If you could invest in the S&P 500 without, you know, the 13 companies that are the worst according to ESG principles, then yeah, why wouldn't you, right? But I think where it's going to become, where direct indexing is going to become a real factor is with institutions. And institutions have something like $30, $31 trillion locked up in investments with ESG mandates associated with them. And I can't see that, you know, that money is not in ESG ETFs right now. It's in SMA accounts, right? It's in SMAs. And so it's not in mutual funds. It's not in ETFs. I can't see direct indexing being a threat to ESG ETFs. I see it as a threat to those accounts, to SMAs, because, you know, that seems to be where like institutions would want that sort of precision. And, you know, with direct indexing, you can get that precision for less cost. So, you know, that's where the money will be taken from. The ESG ETFs, I think if you could do the strategy in an SMA, you probably already are doing it in an SMA. You're not using an ESG ETF. Those are for us, the rest of us plebes, right? So, you know, that's, I think there's going to continue to be a market for ESG ETFs. The reason being that they're going to continue to take market share from mutual funds. So, and I think it's Todd Rosenbluth who's brought this up again and again. There's a lot of money locked in mutual funds right now that can't make the transition to ETFs because of taxes. You get slammed with taxes by making that transition. So, you know, I think that's really what's holding back ESG ETFs still to this day.
Well, I know I keep saying the same thing every time we talk, but this space actually fascinates me because there is so much focus on ESG. We're guilty of it, right? We covered a lot. Assets have started to come into some of these products, but overall, it's still a small sliver of the ETF landscape. And then, you know, you add on direct indexing. There's a lot more talk around that and how that plays out. Mm-hmm. I just think my guess is this will not be our last conversation on ESG.
I don't think so either. I think I honestly believe that this is the year that ESG is going to break out. We're already seeing it happen. This year, 2019, I am putting my stake in the ground. I believe this is going to be the turning point.
Well, Laura, we'll have to leave it there. Fantastic stuff as always. Appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
That was ETF.com's Laura Krieger. That'll do it for this week's ETF Prime. I want to thank our exclusive sponsor, Legg Mason. You can visit leggmason.com to learn more about their broad range of investment strategies. If you enjoyed this week's podcast, we would greatly appreciate if you could drop us a quick review wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps other listeners find the show. You can also send us comments on Twitter at ETF Prime. Next week, we'll be joined by Sam Masusi, CEO of ETF Managers Group. We're going to discuss the largest marijuana ETF, the ETFMG Alternative Harvest ETF, and then we'll also look at their mobile payments ETF. And also, Equibot's Art Amador is going to explain their two ETFs, which use artificial intelligence to select holdings. Until then, have a great week, everyone.